So I'm going to continue with the history of India, an introduction to the history of India. Yeah, so I spoke last week about how the British had colonized India in a rather specific way. It's such a huge place that for an initial period it had been privatized colonization. And so the East India Company had dealt with it, and this came to the explosion of 1857, what the British used to call the Indian Mutiny, and what the Indians tend to call the First War of Independence. And this was a shock. I mean, the British had really thought that the Indians were happy to be there, and also the kind of racist ideas that you can find today were much more common before. There's no comparison. In fact, in general, certainly in Britain, the everyday racism has enormously declined, even since I was a child. And so there you get a couple more results of all that. Queen Victoria being named Empress of India, which was considered as a way of pleasing the Indian elites. And in general, after the terrible repression of 1857, 1858, the British did begin to form a local elite. They allowed the more Indian people to become lawyers and doctors and give them a little bit of space within the society, not everything for the white people. Of course, the danger of this, if you're a colonial power, and don't forget this if ever you become a colonial power, is that if you give a little bit of space, then people begin to say, hey, you know, do we really need these British? Yeah? And so the very beginnings of the independence movement emerged. And when the independence movement emerged, it emerged among the Indian elite. Yeah, the first people to revolt for independence were not poor peasants, because poor peasants have other things to do. You know, and so you get these two enormous events. The first of all, the Indian National Congress being founded, and this is still an important political party today, in 1885. Then the formation of the Muslim League, which shows that a section of the Muslim elite was not satisfied. They did not believe that the Indian National Congress, which in theory was for everybody, but the division and the mistreatment of Muslims in many parts of India was so strong that said, no, we need our own organization, which of course has negative consequences as well as positive consequences. So the Indian National Congress moves it forward, and these were people who were looking for initially more rights for Indians, and they will slowly become more and more about independence. Even Gandhi, who I will be speaking about in a moment, was not initially in favour of independence. He thought some sort of autonomous government with keeping the Queen and things like that would be perfectly acceptable at the beginning, but we will see how he's changed his mind. Now, of course, as you will not be surprised to see, all the members of the Indian National Congress are men, but this was also the case in the political parties founded in France or in England at this time. This was the way that things worked. The first Indian National Congress in 1885. So this is still a very, very strictly divided society. And in fact, in 1946, when they had a new viceroy, a new representative of the Queen in India, this was Lord Mountbatten, who was the last viceroy, and he shocked everybody because he invited some Indian people to dinner. That is to say that's how divided it was, that they would not have Indian people in the house if they were not servants. You know, it's extremely difficult to imagine. Remember, the British in India had nothing to do. You sometimes see in the films an Indian man sat in the corner pulling the fans for the ventilation. That's how little the British did in India. In fact, they did so little that they had time to invent cricket. Cricket is incredible. Do you know how long a cricket match lasts? 5 days. It lasts 5 days. It's an incredible thing, cricket, actually, because you know how I mean, playing a game for 5 days, watching a game for 5 days. The British listened to cricket on the radio. I mean, it's like watching paint dry, you know. It's incredible. No, that's not the main point. Okay, so tremendously divided society and the beginnings of a reaction. And, of course, the gentleman who will make the biggest difference is Mahatma Gandhi, Mohandas Gandhi. This is what Albert Einstein wrote about him. Generations to come will scarce believe that such a one as this ever in flesh and blood walked upon this earth. Now, if Albert Einstein writes something like that about you, you can be proud, I think. You know, it's pretty cool, yeah? Pretty cool. Now, of course, he was not a saint, because the saints don't really exist. I put on the blog a link to an important film about him in 1982, which was a fascinating film, because for the first time, a big British producer made a film about the independence movement against Britain. And when you watch the film, naturally enough, the British don't come out as very nice, as a very nice force for progress in it. So it was a very, very important film, 1982 film about Gandhi, also a very good film. Now, it is no doubt true that it is excessively uncritical. Gandhi was a contradictory figure, like we all are. So, for example, he believed that India should go back to its traditional culture. Yeah, and so he would not allow certain kinds of medicine, etc. In his community, and this could be, you know, this could sometimes be very dangerous. Also, he generally believed that India should go back to the village economy, the traditional village economy. And of course, as has been tested in many parts of the world, you can't actually do this in the 20th century. It feels like a good idea, but it doesn't work like that. Not least because the village economy, of course, gave a very low life expectancy. So there was a certain amount of sort of romantic nostalgia about him. Nevertheless, an extremely impressive leader and politician, and he humiliated the British Empire, which was the biggest empire in the history of the world. So, you know, it's pretty cool. So what happens to him? I'm just giving you a very brief biography of him. How much do you know about Gandhi already? Would you like to be obliged to speak for 15 minutes about Gandhi? No, you don't know enough. Do you know a few things? Very, very. You knew his name? Yeah, you knew his name. And a few things, a few sentences. Okay, well, a little bit more then. He began working in South Africa for Indian rights. At the time, in South Africa, very segregated society, whites, blacks, and coloureds. Which was a way, which was a way of dividing people even more, of course. Now, interestingly enough, at this time, when he was in South Africa, although he organized some very effective campaigns, he was not very much appreciated by the black leaders, because he wasn't very interested in their struggles. You know, he was a sectional fighter, which is an important thing. And he comes across this new idea, which is what characterizes him, I think, of satyagraha, which is often translated as the power of truth or non-violence. Although it's important to recognize that it was recommending non-violent action. And Gandhi once said, there are three possibilities: passivity, violence, or non-violent action, and the worst is passivity. Yeah. So it was very much about non-violent action, which is very important, because since, of course, once he was dead, everyone said, "Oh yes, do nothing," like Gandhi did. But that wasn't the result. It was all about action. And this is one of his quotations: "I object to violence because when it appears to do good, the good is only temporary; the evil it does is permanent." So this is the idea that what you have to do is you have to touch the heart of your enemy. And this is a very original idea, and also, you know, you don't have to agree or disagree, that's not the problem. It's been tremendously influential, of course, Martin Luther King and the Black Civil Rights Movement, but also in Northern Ireland, across the world. It's a major philosophy of the 20th century in some aspects. In the middle of the First World War, Gandhi returned to India. And for many years, he is kind of torn between forming a village commune and living differently and being involved in political action. And this is still a debate today. You know, is the most important thing how you individually live? You know, what is your carbon footprint? Do you wear leather shoes? Or is political action the best way to change the world? The idea of example or organisation as alternatives. But very quickly, he gets involved in 1918 in organising a trade union for poor farmers against oppressive taxation. And this is colonial taxation. That is, that people were hungry, but the British still wanted the taxes. You know, it wasn't a detail. We all hate paying taxes, because who likes paying taxes? But this was something else. And one of the examples we'll see in a moment is that salts, there was a big tax on salts. This is also, of course, goes back into the history of France as well. Whereas, in fact, salt is tremendously important when you don't have a fridge. It's the only way of preserving meat and so on. And so it really is important to life. And it's also a symbol of colonial rule, which we will come to in a moment. Now, Gandhi joined the First World War was not opposed to the British Empire. At this time, he thought that the British Empire was a positive influence in the world, but making a lot of mistakes. This is not surprising. He was brought up as a lawyer. As an educated man within the empire. Of course, he'd always learnt that the empire was a force for good. You know, so it takes a while to get out of that. But notably, in April 1918, he agreed to recruit Indians for the British for the First World War. Yeah, so he wasn't at this time purely interested in pacifism. And that was quite exceptional. It was the only time he did that, because previously, in 1906 and 1914, he had recruited for the ambulance corps, for those people who go to the front line, very brave people, but only to do paramedical work. So this is just something which is less well known about India. Once the war was coming to an end, Gandhi will organise the poor farmers, and in particular, he will organise them into mass action, mass non-violent action. Okay, you may be taking so too many notes. This should say 1906 ambulance, 1918 soldiers. That's the notes. That's all. Okay. So this organising of poor farmers. Here you have a little explanation of it. And remember, of course, how big India is. Millions and millions of people in quite a number of different situations. Because the British method of controlling India was to have British India, one section, and then 500 different little kingdoms ruled by princes who were controlled by Britain. So 500 different princedoms, which is, of course, a lot about divide and rule, and will cause tremendous problems in the future. So here he concentrated on the large number of serfs, indentured labourers, and poor farmers who were forced to grow indigo and other cash crops instead of the food crops necessary for their survival. So a typical colonial situation around the world where you can't grow the food you need, because you're obliged to grow crops which give you cash to pay the taxes. Yeah. Various different situations. A serf, this is like in perhaps you've forgotten what serfs are. Serfs are people who work the land and are not allowed to move, and they pay a percentage of the production. They can keep a percentage of the production. And indentured labourers, it's almost like slavery. It's not exactly slavery, but it's that you're not allowed to leave your job. Any case. And so he brings up this idea, non-violence, mass civil disobedience. Now you can imagine the poor farmers must be such a what? Now, I mean, you can imagine, WTF, you know, what on earth is that? And nevertheless, he successfully gets large numbers of people to do this. Now, I don't have personally a specific attachment to non-violence, but it's true that when the other side, the British, if they organised an armed struggle, they would certainly lose against the British Empire. The British Empire is just so big. So there were tactical advantages to mass civil disobedience. And here you have some of the photographs of them coming on here. You also get here some of the beginnings. This is Gandhi in 1918. You get some of the beginnings of other aspects of Gandhi's philosophy. Look at the clothes. When he was younger, he wore clothes of a Western lawyer. He was a lawyer. He wore clothes like a lawyer. And this wearing cloth in this way was about, you know, let's not pretend to be Western. Let's be proud of Indian tradition. So that's the end of the First World War. And once you came to the end of the First World War, there was a movement for more democratic rights. I can't remember the exact details, and you see this in the film, in fact. And this most terrible event in 1919, the Amritsar massacre. We don't have photographs there. And this was a peaceful demonstration in a closed area, like a big square. There's no way out. And the British general said it's an illegal demonstration, and he told his troops to just shoot them down, and between 400 and 1,000 people were dead, and more thousands injured. And they couldn't get away. You know, it wasn't to clear the square; it was just to teach them a lesson. So a horrific event, which went around the world. Have you heard of this massacre before? Yeah. We British, we keep it very quiet. You know, we're not very proud. The terrible thing about it, one of the terrible things about it, is that the general, Dwyer, I think his name was, when he came back to England, there was a demonstration in support of him when he arrived. Yeah, so it was really, you could see the very terrible situation. He was obliged to there was a tribunal, but I'm pretty sure that he was okay, you know, that he didn't get worried about that. Now, this was tremendously important, because this was a peaceful demonstration for more democratic rights. And many of the people present thought, we can persuade the British Empire to treat us better. But after this demonstration, Gandhi and many more people thought, oh, no, we need independence. Because, you know, it was that moment that made people that you couldn't get back to it. So they went too far, and this was at the Amritsar Golden Temple. That's the place where it was. It was in that not in the water, but it was in that area at Amritsar, if I understand correctly. And so the campaign against the British Empire, the campaign for independence, included many, many different tactics. For example, Gandhi and other leaders. I mean, of course, we talk about Gandhi because it's difficult to talk about 123 leaders, but so we just talk about one, but he wasn't alone. They organized a boycott of British cloth. Now, perhaps you remember the cotton industry was extremely important to Britain. It was the centre, and they exported to India. Now, even though the Indians were poor, there were 100 million of them. And so there was big money in cotton going to India. That is, of course, the cotton came from the United States and was made into shirts, mostly, and sheets and so on, and exported out. This was big money. And so they organised this boycott British cloth, which was both an economic sanction against Britain and a humiliation. Because remember that Britain, the British Empire, was also the elite needed to present it as a civilizing influence. And so the symbolism was very, 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 very important. And they played with him, and he was arrested and imprisoned and then released and so on. However, also at this time and up till today, quite frequently, violent clashes between Muslim groups and Hindu groups. Now, India is a huge place with many, many different states. So when you hear about fighting between Hindus and Muslims in one state, you know, it doesn't mean that it's happening in all the states all the time. You know, it's a bit like if you went to China 20 years ago, they'd say, "Oh, you're from Europe. It's terrible in Europe. I've heard about the terrible war." I'd say, "What? What war? In Yugoslavia?" "Well, it's Europe." "Yeah, well, it's the same with India. It's enormous. And there are many parts where there's not so much violence going on." So one of Gandhi's tactics was to fast, yet to refuse to eat. And he had some success reducing conflict between Hindus and Muslims by refusing to eat and trying to impress them on that. And he was... Also, in 1925, then he founds an association, an organization, the All India Spinners Association, to spin, c'est filer, c'est produire du fil. That is to say, instead of buying British cloth, making your own. And so he actually founded an organization for this. And he said, you know, what we need to do is everybody in all the villages needs to refuse to buy British cloth and make their own. And so he made his own clothes. Now, this was both a political tactic, but also an idea that if you make your own clothes, you are more spiritual. Yeah, it's also a very much a religious thing. It's not just it's politics and religion together. Now, I know today people are not so happy with politics and religion together, but it tends to happen anyway. And so the All Indian Spinners Association, important thing there. There is Gandhi spinning. J'ai déjà vu de meilleures publicités pour la bouffe végétarienne. He's still alive. So, primarily advocated as a solution to chronic underemployment, the spinning wheel in Gandhi's hands became something more than a simple tool of a cottage industry. He put it forward not only as a panacea for economic ills, but also for national unity and freedom. So it was a tremendously interesting idea. So I think you can see that he's a very political thinker. He said, you know, what is a question? Because when you're a political leader of an enormous nation, then you must not say, there are 17 important questions. Because that politically, you can never say there are 17. There are two. Because that allows people to grasp onto it, in my opinion. So there he is, working on that. Now, in the Indian Congress, this is not the parliament, the Congress is a party. Be careful with the word Congress. In India, Congress is a party. It's not an institution. And they decide then in 1930 that the time has come, we're strong enough, we want to actually declare independence. Now, of course, there's a tradition to this. In 1916, the Irish Republicans declared the independence of Ireland. Of course, the problem is if somebody else has an army and you don't, your declaration doesn't last very long. And that's kind of what happened. In 1930, the Indian Congress declared the independence of India. But the British were not going to leave for another 17 years. And here is the declaration of the Indian Congress in 1930. "We believe that it is the inalienable right of the Indian people, as of any other people, to have freedom and to enjoy the fruits of their toil and have the necessities of life so that they may have full opportunities of growth. We believe also that if any government deprives a people of these rights and oppresses them, the people have a further right to alter it or abolish it. The British government in India has not only deprived the Indian people of their freedom, but has based itself on the exploitation of the masses and has ruined India economically, spiritually, economically, politically, culturally, and spiritually. We believe, therefore, that India must sever the British connection and attain Purna Swaraj, or complete sovereignty and self-rule." So there are a few interesting things there. First of all, notice that the key concepts they have left in some other language. I don't even know what language. Because sometimes these things are difficult to translate. I know in New Zealand, the demand for indigenous rights is represented by a very, very long word. which they always use in English because it's apparently impossible to translate. Also in this document, they refer to history, the inalienable rights. It's the US Constitution. They're making references to India. And also they are an enormous accusation here. Notice that they're not saying British rule was okay, but enough is enough. They're saying the British rule has ruined India economically, politically, culturally, and spiritually. Now, of course, this is always a matter of opinion. Nevertheless, when the British left India in 1947, the average income per person was approximately the same as when the British arrived in 250 years earlier. So it's not a very impressive record if you consider that the technology and the living standards in Europe had steadily risen. Now, interestingly enough, that there would be, you might think that there was enough distrust and bitterness towards Britain to have bad relations for a long, long time. But in fact, relations between India and Britain have been relatively good until quite recently. In 1930, also, one of Gandhi's most famous campaigns went on. I can only give you a couple of examples of his campaign. He did dozens and dozens and dozens, but here's a very fascinating one, the Great Salt Marches. Has anybody heard of the Great Salt Marches? Do you know what they were doing? Where did they go? What did they do? Well, what they wanted to do was to humiliate the British Empire on the front pages of every newspaper in the world. And they chose one issue. Now, of course, there are 23 terrible injustices. They chose one, because that's how you do politics, especially humiliation politics. And they chose the salt. The British government, the British Empire, Imperial government, had a monopoly on salt. It was illegal for you to make salt or to sell salt. And this was big money, of course. Everybody needed salt. Nobody had a fridge, yeah? So everybody needed salt. And the British Empire had a monopoly. How difficult is it to find salt in India normally? Well, it's surrounded by sea and scoop. There is salt in the sea. Okay. Yeah. So in fact, they chose this question of salt because it was so ridiculous. India is completely surrounded by thousands and thousands of kilometers of sea, which could easily produce salt, and yet it's illegal. And so they said, this is a symbol, of course salt is not the only problem, this is a symbol of our humiliation as the Indian people. And so what he did is said, we're going to have a big march, we're going to march to the sea, and we're going to make salt. It's not very difficult to do. I don't know how to do it, but I'm told it's not very difficult to do. But of course, if you're going to do politics, you'll have to make sure all the journalists know. So you go, we're going to have a 3-month march to this town, and then this town, and then this town, and then this town. We'll have a meeting in every town, and when we arrive at the sea, we will make some salt. They were on every television channel in the world, every radio in the world. There were not many television channels, more radio. And in every newspaper in the world. And when they arrived at the sea, the British were very violent and arrested thousands of people and put them in jail. But politically, it was certainly a victory for Gandhi, because they had shown, first of all, mass action against this situation. Secondly, they had shown it as non-violence. Now, the advantage of non-violent in this case was that the white establishment in Britain and in Europe considered that the Indians were savage. And so there was a political advantage to non-violence in this particular case, to smash the things. And so there they are, having a good time doing that. And here they are. This is men and women who have just been to the sea, and what they have there is the salt they just made. Yeah. So of course, in many ways, the symbolic import is bigger than the actual. Yeah, if you're going to walk 300 miles and I'll give you some salt. Well, thanks. No thanks. I have to paint my bathroom. But, tremendously important. But then understanding the importance of symbols in politics, That's if you want to be a political leader, that's a big one. That's a big one. You really need to understand the symbols of politics, of the importance of symbols in politics. We're going to have a break for 5 minutes, and then I've got to tell you the rest of the story.